This is a Sandler training audiobook, produced and distributed by Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, in partnership with Sandler Training. Negotiating from the Inside Out, a playbook for business success, by Clint Babcock, narrated by Graham Rowett. We hope you enjoy this program. Forward. Years ago, I was teaching a 2-day negotiation program for a large financial institution. This client was enrolling employees from various divisions across the company, with locations on different coasts, to take part in the Sandler negotiating program. At the last minute, I got a call from a contact at the company who informed me that they wanted to negotiate us down on the price. They were paying us per person, and suddenly realized they were going to be paying for a lot of people. About 400 in all were scheduled to be in the room. My contact wanted us to agree to a lower per-person rate. Ironically, I was being hired to teach them not to negotiate on pricing. This, I realized, was a classic moment of truth, a moment when I had to decide for myself if I was going to walk my talk. I explained to my contact that I would be a hypocrite and a fraud if I agreed to negotiate on the price. Then I told him that I had a suggestion. We could cancel, but they would need to cancel hundreds of plane tickets and hotel nights. Or, better yet, I could throw in an added service. I knew that eventually they were going to ask us to provide management training, so I offered to stay an extra day to cover management, which they could then reinforce with the people who took the program. He agreed. We ended up keeping the per-person price as it was. They were happy, I was happy, and I didn't have to negotiate pricing. Not only that, I had a great addition to the program that I wouldn't have otherwise had. I used that very story to land the point with them, and later with countless other clients, never to negotiate price, but to instead negotiate service. I believe that, sooner or later, salespeople all face major moments of truth when it comes to negotiating. Clint Babcock's book covers them all. It gives the tools to effectively respond in real time to any of the major gambits. Just as important, Babcock's book shows how to address the biggest challenges to constructive negotiation that any of us face, our own internal attitudes and beliefs. Negotiating from the Inside Out is a powerful summary of the core Sandler principles for successful negotiating outcomes. Read it, practice it, reinforce it, and use it to turn your own moment of truth into a moment of mutual success. David Matson, President and CEO, Sandler Training. Introduction. Many of the business leaders and sales professionals my company works with tell us they are frustrated by a total lack of process when it comes to negotiation. When we ask them what their internal negotiation system is, they shake their heads and admit that they don't have such a system for their people to follow. Team members who routinely negotiate against themselves, offering price cuts and other major concessions without even being asked to do so by the other side. Margins that get undermined or destroyed altogether by negotiators who ask for and receive major concessions from team members who don't realize they're being played. If one or more of these issues arises in your world, you may want to keep reading. I wrote this book to help teams and organizations recognize and overcome all of these challenges. Let's get started. Part 1. The Inner Game of Negotiating. Chapter 1. Start with the mirror. It's all about you, at first. Years ago, I was the regional manager for a technology training company, overseeing 5 locations. We were a small division of a $5 billion technology and printing firm. My world shifted a bit when my division was sold to a private equity firm. One of the first initiatives of the new company's leadership was to consolidate accounting systems. Translation: we had to move our local accounting function to our new corporate office. We had to use their software and stop using the software we were used to. This was a major transition, and we had our issues. One of the biggest challenges had to do with invoicing our customers. We experienced over 4 months of invoicing chaos. Sometimes invoices went out incorrectly, sometimes they went out too late, and sometimes they didn't go out at all. By the time we started to get a handle on the problem, our account receivables had ballooned. I found myself spending a lot of time calling on our customers to apologize and work through all the mistakes. One of our largest customers, a well-known national bank, had asked us to come in so we could figure out some way out of the maze. By our count, which we had double and triple checked, they owed us a little over $100,000. Yet the invoicing had been so problematic and the mistakes so complex that their finance and training people still had a lot of questions. Suffice to say that this was an important meeting. My marketplace manager spent days preparing the data, and we both invested a lot of time getting ready. As we sat in their conference room at their headquarters, handouts at the ready, awaiting the arrival of their vice president of training and development, we chatted with three of the bank's other team members. We talked about the weather. We talked about the local sports team. You get the picture. Happy talk. Casual chit-chat. All of a sudden, in walks the VP. The atmosphere instantly changes. The three people we've been chatting with stop smiling and start frowning. The VP doesn't say hello. He doesn't sit down, and he doesn't make eye contact. He stands at the head of the table and says, "Look, you guys have already cost us so much time trying to figure out your invoices, which classes we have taken, and which ones we haven't, that I don't believe we should pay you anything. However, here's what we've been able to figure out on our side. We owe you about $70,000. We'll pay you $70,000 within the next week and call it even and then move forward. Now I've got to go to another meeting. It's a busy day here, and I don't have any more time for this. Just let us know what you decide." There was a split-second pause, and during that pause, he made eye contact with me for the very first time. As he did, I'm sure he sensed the fear that his words had brought about in me. That, of course, was his desired outcome. Having produced that outcome, he turned and walked out of the room. Negotiation over. Suffice it to say, I was unprepared to deal with someone like him. As I reflect upon that situation, I can't help remembering the depth of the panic and stress I experienced in that moment. I can't help thinking about how little I had done to prepare myself, not just tactically, but mentally and emotionally, for that meeting. The VP didn't beat me at the negotiating table. I beat me. Today, I realize I would have had a much better outcome had I had the strong belief and mindset that our information was correct. It was. We had all our ducks in a row. But deep down, I felt my leverage was not very strong because I knew that we were the ones who had caused the invoicing issues. My belief structure and my mental and emotional starting point were all wrong. As a result, I walked in the door hoping to please. I began the meeting at a disadvantage. Not only that, I didn't recognize the tactic being used on me for what it was. A tactic. If I'd been able to recognize the negotiations gambit the VP had just used to take me off guard, a quick and decisive demand followed by an apparent collapse of discussions, I could have responded to it much more effectively than I did. Knowing what you're likely to be up against is a critical part of the mental game of negotiation. The knowledge you have makes it more likely that you will respond maturely and resourcefully in a potentially stressful situation. Finally, even though I was prepared with all the data as I walked into that room, I look back now and realize how unprepared I was tactically. I'd been totally caught off guard, with no response at the ready, because I hadn't realized that the game could begin at any moment. It didn't occur to me to have a response ready just in case someone threw me a curveball. I was literally speechless. The moment of truth came during the instant that he looked at me for a response, and I was completely unprepared. I collapsed. That collapse was entirely preventable. If I had done a better job of preparing tactically, I would not have caved at the moment of truth, and he could not have taken advantage of me in the way that he did. What I want you to notice is that it was my own choices and my own internal responses that caused me to get crushed in that negotiation, such as it was. And there were lots of people counting on me. I had let down not just myself, but my whole team. I tell you this story for a simple reason. The best place to begin any discussion about negotiation is by consulting the nearest mirror. You have to start with yourself. At the beginning, at least, it is really all about you. What you choose to do and not do before entering a negotiation discussion. How you think about yourself and the world around you, and whether you respond consciously or react heedlessly and emotionally at the moment of truth. In this first chapter, we'll look closely at the only thing you truly have total control over in any negotiating situation, the mind and emotions of the person you see staring back at you when you look in the mirror. How you defeat yourself. Negotiation is a skill. The first thing you have to do to improve that skill is to understand your own current skill level, how you react to pressure situations, and how you negotiate for yourself and for your companies. Always begin with where you are right now. Where I was at the moment that the VP beat me was a place called I Am Not Enough. This is the most common way to defeat yourself in negotiations. If you don't approach the negotiating discussion as a peer, you will lose. In my case, I was beginning the exchange from a position of subservience, of deficiency. This left me unable to manage my own emotions, and as a result, I lost the negotiating encounter. Maybe the same thing has happened to you. To illustrate the nature of that deficiency, I'd like to do a little imaginative exercise with you. What's your emotional bounce-back rate when something in business goes wrong? Do you take it personally when you are rejected in business, lose a deal, or receive constructive criticism from a manager or client? As you start to look inward, it's important to understand identity and role theory, which can help you not only become a better negotiator, but show you how to deal with outcomes that may not be in your favor. First, the easy part. Roles. Everyone has a lot of roles to play in life. Spouse, employee, sibling, athlete, student, child. At any moment during the day, people are moving in and out of these roles. If you've just left work and your best friend calls you, you immediately and smoothly transition from employee into friend role. Understanding this, there are times when you are awesome at these roles, and there are times you might struggle or fail. The same goes for you as a negotiator. Therefore, it's important to spend time working on these roles. If you want to become a better athlete, then you practice, practice, practice. If you want to become a better life partner, then you'll put in the time and change your behaviors in order to be better. However, if you fail at these roles, does this affect your core values and how you think and believe about yourself? Although no one likes to fail, understand that everyone does at one time or another. As long as you don't let that affect your belief in yourself, you'll be ensuring that you consistently perform at a high level in your roles because of a strong identity. However, if you aren't aware of how you are seeing yourself internally, your identity, then you'll struggle to consistently perform well in your roles. Your identity is your core values, your self-esteem and self-image, and your inner mindset. It's that voice that tells you you're a solid person of character and values who wants the best for other people and for yourself. Because of this, your ability to perform well in your roles is directly correlated to how you see yourself in your identity. People who have a strong identity belief will fail at times in their roles. However, because of their self-image, they won't let a failure affect their internal belief in themselves. They'll begin to work on how to improve in their role to avoid another role failure. Do you know someone who doesn't think very highly of themselves? Someone who routinely talks down about not only themselves, but tends to bring others down with them as well. What about the person who makes excuses and doesn't accept responsibility for their own failure, and, when they win, they think victory is just one of those things that happens? Oh, and how about the person you may know who feels like the world is stacked against them because of something that may have happened to them in their past? These people will usually have a low sense of identity and self-worth, and therefore will consistently perform poorly in their roles. At the very least, they will have inconsistent patterns of ups and downs. They don't believe they deserve the ups in their life, so they'll self-sabotage their wins to get themselves back in line with their non-winner identity. On the other hand, seeing yourself internally as a winner will enhance your role as a negotiator. If you enter into a negotiation with the right mindset about yourself, you'll consistently perform as a winner at the negotiation table. You'll be able to use the tactics and strategies outlined in this book because you will have the drive to learn more, which strengthens the mind and prepares you to perform. For a real-world example of how the identity and role theory works, consider the following example. Maybe you've experienced something like this. In the recession of 2007 to 2009, companies were laying off people every day. The unemployment rate in the United States jumped from just under 5% to over 10%. Or consider the pandemic of 2020, which, among many other dire effects, caused unemployment to reach even higher levels through both layoffs and furloughs. Did you or someone you knew lose their job for no other reason than companies slashing headcount? This could be you, or it could be a friend or family member, even a parent. Think of that person now, or put yourself in the position of someone facing that situation. That individual lost their job not because of their performance, but because the company had to downsize. After having an identity associated with what they did for a living that was not there anymore, many felt depressed and unsure about who they were. They identified themselves so much with what they did for a living, their role, that they confused the two. When the role no longer existed, the person struggled with their self-belief and value. But what you do for a living is not your identity. It's a role, and roles change. Odds are, you've had a few different roles in your career, but your identity was not left behind in your last job. During that earlier recession, I was consistently asked to deliver job prospecting and interviewing talks to numerous groups of unemployed people, sometimes numbering in the hundreds. Some of these people had been out of work for 6 to 12 months and had barely been able to secure a single interview. I would share with them certain strategies about how to find the hidden jobs that are not advertised, how to network better and build a network, how to use LinkedIn, and how to handle interviews. I gave them a lot of tactics. Then, I would always end my talk explaining identity and role theory. This concept consistently resonated more powerfully with everyone than anything else I discussed. It was a silent internal challenge they couldn't describe, but they knew was there. I was just able to put their feelings into terms that they could understand and easily grasp. Separating your identity from your role is, from one perspective, the work of a lifetime. It's not something you grasp and forget about. It's something you keep working on over time. It's something you have to practice continually. Put on your buyer's hat for a moment. Do you find yourself trying to negotiate on a regular basis? I'm not just talking about typical situations like buying a car or a house. I'm talking about negotiating at the golf course for a foursome, your dry cleaner for a deadline, your cable bill for a discount, or even your vacation with the family for an extra treat. I believe the better negotiator you are as a buyer, the stronger a negotiator you will be as a seller. What you will learn as you move forward in this book is that there are certain gambits buyers use to create leverage. The better you are at recognizing and using these buyer strategies, and the more practice you give yourself at separating your role from your identity, the better you will be at responding to buyer strategies when someone tries to use them against you. Chapter 2. DISC. The best negotiators always start negotiation by negotiating with themselves. This means understanding whether the self-talk in your mind develops your confidence and your sense of self-worth or undermines you. It also means getting to know your own communication and behavioral style, which has a lot to do with how you think and react under pressure. One of the communication tools that will help you better understand yourself and how others communicate with you is called DISC. If you haven't heard of DISC, it's time to become familiar with it. If you have heard of it, it's time for a deeper dive. This will be painless, I promise. Fill in the blanks, associating each sentence with people you know. Profile number 1. I'm a self-starter and a born risk-taker. I love solving problems. People say I have a healthy ego. I'm direct in my dealings with you. I live to make decisions. My secret fear is that someone will take advantage of me. A colleague who fits this description is blank. A prospect or client who fits this description is blank. Profile number two. I'm extremely enthusiastic, talkative, and persuasive. I draw energy from groups and thrive in social situations. I motivate others to achieve at a high level. I'm usually optimistic. People sometimes say I'm too emotional. At my best, I'm downright inspirational. My secret fear is rejection. A colleague who fits this description is blank. A prospect or client who fits this description is blank. Profile number three. I'm a great listener, loyal to the end, and eager to understand you. Some people call me the ultimate team player. Relationships mean a lot to me, and I don't like to let an ally down. I'm a peacekeeper. I'm reliable and dependable. My biggest fear is a loss of security. A colleague who fits this description is blank. A prospect or client who fits this description is blank. Profile number four. I have high standards. I work systematically. I'm precise. I find out the facts. I'm cautious, careful, and conscientious. I'm rigorously analytical. It's extremely important to me to be accurate and well-organized. My secret fear is being forced to choose between quality and relationships because I will lean toward quality. A colleague who fits this description is blank. A prospect or client who fits this description is blank. And now for the big question. The profile that most closely describes me is number one, number two, number three, or number four. People you aligned with profile number one are likely dominants. People you aligned with profile number two are likely influencers. People you aligned with profile number three are likely steady relators. People you aligned with profile number four are likely compliance. Now for the big question. Which style did you identify as your own? If you're like most of the people we work with, one profile jumped out at you as instinctive, as natural, as normal. In reality, there is no normal, but there are means of communicating, behaving, and interacting that feel intuitive to us. Which of the four styles felt most intuitive to you? As you read through these descriptions of the four DISC behavioral styles, confirm whether your initial guess about your own style matches up with the summaries. A dominant is aggressive, blunt, bottom-line oriented, results-oriented, impatient, easily irritated, demanding, competitive, fond of change, goal-oriented. An influencer is talkative, animated, easily excited, open and friendly, unorganized, known for a short attention span, constantly jumping from subject to subject, a collaborative decision maker, positive. A steady relator is easygoing, calm, a careful listener, thoughtful, someone who needs time to process information, someone who asks questions, opinionated, but does not express opinions openly. Resistant to change. Resistant to risk. Attracted to mutually fair solutions. A compliant is facts-oriented. An analyzer. Fond of rules. Responsive to instruction. Quiet. Someone who asks many questions. Reserved and timid. A researcher. An examiner of specifics. Resistant to personal criticism. So, which one of the four styles feels most like you? Have you got a clear sense of that now? Each of the four behavioral styles is like a language unto itself. The more languages you speak, and the more fluently you speak them, the more effective your interactions with others will be, and the more success you will have as a negotiator. Think of it this way. Most people only speak one DISC language, their own. They tell themselves that they simply don't connect or can't connect with certain types of people. Most people buy into that kind of negative self-talk, and, as a result, they interact imperfectly and inefficiently with roughly 75% of the population. How much more could they accomplish if they spoke all four of the disc languages? For my part, I am a steady relator. Most of us are non-confrontational by nature. Not only that, we avoid taking risks, we love being part of a team, and we are not happy about change. Now, one of the prospects I was dealing with a few years back was a woman I'll call Georgiana, who was a nice high dominant, strong in that quadrant, which meant her natural inclinations were in the exact opposite direction of mine. She was very comfortable confronting people, happy to take risks in pursuit of a goal, enjoyed making decisions on her own, and loved shaking things up. Georgiana and I got to a point in the sales process where I said to her, "You're probably going to want to take this outline we put together back to your team so you can talk with them and get their feedback, and you can decide what you feel most comfortable doing. Meanwhile, I'll talk to my team about this, and we'll meet next week." Classic steady relator. I'm a team player, and I assumed she was also. Why wouldn't she be? Because she's a high dominant. Georgiana said, "Clint, I've got a better idea. I've already talked to my team. They're on board with this. Let me tell you what's going to happen if we wait a week. You're going to come back with a number. I'm not going to like it. I'm going to tell you to come off that number. You're going to change the program a little bit so you can justify coming off that number, and then we're going to do business together. So why don't we just save each other some time and energy and do all of that right now, you and me?" That's what we did. If I had followed my inclinations rather than hers, the inclination of both of us going back to our respective teams and talking things over, I would have slowed down my sales cycle and eventually gotten exactly the same outcome. Because I was open to the tendencies and priorities of the dominant, because I wasn't intimidated by them, I was willing to recognize a time when it made sense to step away from my usual process. Note that steady relators love structure. And to start speaking Georgiana's language. Now that you have identified your communication style, you are in a better position to understand the best ways to connect with others and to prioritize what is likely to be most important to them. Remember, as a negotiator, you need to understand the other person's point of view and how they operate. Here is a summary of things to do if you are a D, I, S, or C and are dealing with someone of another style. If you're the same style as the person you're working with, go ahead and just be yourself. Dominant. Be more patient. Talk less, listen more. Allow time for small talk. Slow down your presentation. Focus more on feelings and emotions. Be careful not to dominate the interaction. Be careful not to come across as blunt or impolite. Influencer. Be more direct. Keep to the subject. Talk less, listen more. Remember to follow up. Do not get too emotional. Slow down your presentation. Focus more on details and facts. Be careful not to move too close to others. Steady relator. Talk more. Focus a little less on details. Speed up your presentation. Keep emotions under control. Be more expressive and animated. Be careful not to come across as too opinionated. Be more results-oriented in your communication. Compliant. Talk more. Be more expressive. Spend more time chatting. Focus on being more inspiring. Speak more about people and emotions. Talk less about detail, facts, and figures. Be careful not to appear cold, impolite, and distant. Think of how powerful it is to be able to enter any negotiating situation with the confidence that since you understand communication styles, you are in a much better position to control the direction of the conversation. You can always adjust your communication style to suit the occasion and the person you are working with. Chapter 3. T.A. and the Drama Triangle. It will come as no surprise that the best negotiators are those who are most deeply acquainted with the principles of human psychology. Perhaps the most important school of psychology for anyone aspiring to become a truly effective negotiator is transactional analysis. TA. TA was developed by the psychologist Dr. Eric Byrne in
Sample complete. Ready to continue?